Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he's a Hall of Fame athlete who pitched in Omaha's first College World Series, but only after surviving some dangerous duty during World War II.
It really never entered my mind that we would get shot down. You always think you're going to come back.
He did come back with a story to tell, and we'll hear about his close calls on Navy bombers today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time as we listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, I think we glean those little nuggets of inspiration and education that prove so plentiful when we look back through the lens of history. Our guest today is celebrating his 89th birthday, Don Straub of Windsor, Colorado. That's just outside of Fort Collins, home of Colorado State University. But back on January 18th, 1925, it was snowy Pennsylvania where he was born. Allegheny, to be exact, part of the Pittsburgh area. And Don, what was life like growing up there in Pittsburgh during the Great Depression?
Not much to do except play ball in the streets. Didn't have any activities, never left the city limits.
Were you from a big family, a small family?
A small family. I had a brother who played ball also here in Fort Collins.
Yeah, and your name around Fort Collins is one that people know. They might know you as Lefty. We're going to get into some of those post-war exploits with the Rams here in Fort Collins. Don is in their Hall of Fame. But growing up in Pittsburgh, he said playing ball a lot, and then that changed when the war came along. I like to ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, because everybody seems to have a story of how he found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. What do you remember about that day?
Went to church. And I came home, and that's when the announcement was on the radio. And my dad turned to me and says, "You won't be here next year at this time." And I didn't think anything about it. Well, it was a little longer than that. But that was my December 7th greeting, was when my dad said, "I don't think you'll be here next year."
Yeah, that would get your attention as a 16 going on 17-year-old to even think about that. And was your brother older or younger?
He was younger. He ended up out here in school. In fact, he was out here to play basketball and never did, and played quarterback. So he was a quarterback at Colorado State U years ago when it was A&M in those days.
With those nice orange uniforms?
Oh, yes. We used to kid each other about the pumpkin and alfalfa. Yeah, that was the colors.
We'll get to that in a little bit. So your father, I guess, kind of put that thought in your head early. A lot of guys I talk to say when that happened, you know, it was a shock, but they didn't realize they were going to be part of this. It sounds like you knew right there and then that this might be part of your future.
That's very true, but my mom didn't want me to go. I wanted to go. I went into V5 pilot training, but she wouldn't sign the papers until I graduated from high school, and that's when I went in after my graduation. Got into that and spent maybe 6-7 months. A lot of pilots, and I didn't quite make it. So I ended up in aviation radio gunnery school.
And what made you choose that program, the V5 program, and wanting to be a Navy pilot? Were you hoping to control your own destiny and not be subject to the draft when you decided on your own to go in? Or had you flown before? Did you have some dreams of flying? Where did that come from?
No, I didn't fly before. I was never in an airplane before. All I know is that I wanted to fly and go after the enemy. And that's just the way it was. Everybody wanted to get in and fly. And so that's why I went to the V5 and was able to get through it, but didn't quite make it.
And I've talked to a lot of guys. In fact, you know, all the guys that joined the U.S. Army Air Corps at that time, every single one of them wanted to be a pilot, whether they ended up a navigator or a bombardier or whatever. And I imagine with what you did too, a lot of guys that did what you did in the Navy wanted to be pilots. And some of the guys have shared that it was really devastating when they didn't make that cut or they didn't get to fulfill those flying dreams as a pilot. How did you handle it when they told you, you know what, you're still going to be in the air, but you're not flying the plane?
I was brokenhearted. I really disappointed. But I figured, well, if I'm going to get in the air somewhere, I'm going to be able to go someplace where I can learn and join some squadron. So I went to aviation radio school in Memphis, Tennessee. And then after graduation, went to California, San Diego, went to gunnery school. And that's when I got into the squadron that we were in.
And this was a squadron, not of the plane that you eventually flew most of your missions in, but this is in an SBD Dauntless dive bomber where you sit facing the back of the plane and fire out while your whole body's moving the other way?
That's right. Your back was to the pilot. You had twin 30 caliber machine guns sitting there. I don't know what they were going to knock down, but they looked pretty powerful at that time. But one thing about that SBD it had that the other dive bombers didn't have was dual control. And if there's any possibility of you getting back to your aircraft carrier, you had a chance to ditch it for him in case your pilot was shot up. But the other SP-2C Cutlass that they replaced it with wasn't the same airplane. That Dauntless was a that took us through Coral Sea and the Midway. That was the big airplane that did it all.
Exactly. I've talked to a guy who did exactly what you did on SBDs off of the Big E, the Enterprise at Midway. So what was it like taking off from those carriers, landing on those carriers? Can you give us a sense of what that feels like? Because I imagine some of those thrill rides that people pay big money to go on have nothing on that.
You know, you have no idea what it's going to be like, but I can remember the first time we did some practice landings on the carrier. And the minute the pilot cut back on the engine and laid it out, the whole bottom of the plane was going to come out. But you had to put your trust into that guy, and you did. And they did the job for you. It is a little scary, but not many people get to do it. And I thought, boy, I've accomplished something riding in the back seat.
And was it your expectation that you were going to head out on a carrier and fly some missions in those?
That's what it was, but they kept delaying. Then they replaced the squadron with this SP-2C Cutlass dive bomber. And I thought, no, I decided I was going to look around somewhere else and bumped into another Navy guy who said they're reforming a new squadron of B-24s and maybe you could get transferred. And then from San Diego, I went to Camp Kearney, and that was when they're reforming again the VPB-109. It was a modified B-24, which they took the belly turret out, put two top turrets in, and we were strictly low altitude, but with shipping, radar stations, communication centers. That's what we did, and we traveled the Pacific quite a bit.
Were you guys hunting for submarines a little bit too?
Well, we were looking for everything. Transports, destroyers. We were nailed a couple of times by fighters. We were able to shoot some of those down. But we had traveled quite a bit of there. We'd go for 14, 15 hours flying time out there because we were stationed. I was in the Philippines, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. And we flew off of those strips. Down in the Philippines, we'd fly into Borneo, Shanghai. A lot of island hopping around. The plane was a sturdy, sturdy airplane. A lot of times we'd come back with AK-AK shot and destroyed the propeller. One time we lost the propeller on the darn thing, but we got back.
Well, I want to talk to you about some of those missions. But first, if you can recall, I know it's a long time ago, you went overseas as a teenager. Was it 44 when you went over?
February of 44.
So you're just past your 19th birthday, and here you are going a world away from your whole family. What do you think was going through your mind when you left Honolulu and went toward the Philippines?
You don't even think about those things until you make that first mission run. You get a little activity, or there's been a fatal accident somewhere, but you don't realize until the enemy is shooting at you. And then you realize, hey, I can get killed out here. And that was what happens when you're thinking about things. But that's never thought about it, flying, getting out there, stopping at the various islands to get there, Kwajalein, any we talk, and you don't think until you make that first run. And that's when you say, hey, I hope I get back okay.
Well, and I want to hear about that first one, but I also want you to describe for us your position on the aircraft. And you mentioned it's a converted B-24. The Navy called it a PB-4Y2, is that right?
Privateer. The Liberator was the regular Army B-24. The Navy remodeled it, redesigned it, and we called it the PB-4Y2 Privateer. My position was the radio shack, or the radio compartment, and that turret, the front turret, upper deck turret, I was responsible for that. We had a tail gunner, a bow gunner, and two blister turrets on each side of the airplane, which it was able to extend down to where the two 50 caliber machine guns crossed each other. They gave us protection from underneath. That was the way the things went out there.
but the turret that you operated was right on top of the aircraft and probably didn't quite go 360 degrees because you didn't want to shoot your own tail out?
Funny you should bring that up. My wife said to me when she saw the SBD down in Pensacola, she says, how did you not shoot your tail out? Well, it automatically cuts off. There are sensors that cut it off. But you're primarily shooting from the sides most of the time. You had a tail turret back there who would take care of things coming up on the back. All in all, I would say we had more firepower than what the old B-24 had. We were strictly low altitude. We were 100 feet, 200 feet off of the water because we were looking for supply ships, oil tankers. We got jumped a few times. We got jumped out of Truck Harbor one night. We flew into there just to see what was going on, and we got jumped by a couple of Zeeks over there and then got back okay. But we knocked down a few. We knocked down a couple of Jakes, which was a seaplane, and we knocked down a Roof, which was a land plane. But we had a great squadron. We had a lot of great citations. It was a good outfit.
So you were flying basically every 2-3 days?
Exactly. You were going about every 2 or 3 days is right.
Were you able to keep the same crew together, or were you working with a variety of crews?
We kept our same crew. There was a couple of guys that moved on to another crew, but for the main purpose of it, we kept our crew. We all stayed together.
You must have been pretty close then. You must have had a lot of trust for your pilot and the other guys on that plane.
Oh, yeah. We had a great pilot. He was a great instrument pilot, but he got us back safe. He was very good. There was three pilots aboard. There was a PPC, which is the head guy, and a co-pilot, and the other co-pilot was a navigator. That was the three officers that we had. The rest of us were assigned to the radar gear, the radio gear, or the turrets in the back. They controlled that.
You talked about getting jumped by enemy planes. What happens inside of you when you realize that's happening and that your entire crew's life or death might depend on how accurate you are, if it's your gun that's needed to shoot that enemy plane down?
You had communications all the time. You could talk back and forth where they were coming from, what position they were in, and you covered your position by listening to the other fellows as we worked together. And we were lucky that we didn't get it. We got shot up a couple times. We had some damage from the fighters, but most of the time we could coordinate things pretty much together. And being low, they couldn't get under us. So they were all coming from top side or front and back, aft and fore. So that's how we kept things going pretty safely. We had some accidents. We lost a crewman in the Philippines on a bombing run he was on. The shell off of the ship exploded, and he was in the top turret when it hit him. That was our first casualty.
That was on your aircraft?
No, that was on another aircraft. That really opened your eyes up that you were out in a very bad area. And then we lost a pilot. Same way, he was flying up the Yangtze River, and the Yak-Yak hit the side of the plane, and unfortunately, he didn't make it. And not to conclude this thing, but I want to get to the bomb drop. We were at Okinawa when that happened, and August the 6th is when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. We lost a full crew airplane August 5th. If it had just been one day before, we might not have lost that crew, but we lost a full crew and a plane.
In other words, they wouldn't have had the need to fly the mission that got them killed.
When we heard about this thing, everybody looked at each other. What the heck kind of a bomb could that be? Wipe out a city? No way. We didn't believe it. And then we were told, stand down. Let's not do any patrols until we find out. We found out more about it, and we cut back. We were still going out, but we cut back. But we never saw any more action after that bomb was dropped.
Well, and you hit on that. You're flying 100 to 200 feet off the ground, and you talk about AK-AK, that anti-aircraft fire. You're awfully close to those guns on those ships and on the ground. Did you feel like you were doing dangerous work?
Oh, yeah. We could see the flashes. We could see it all. Primarily, we would fly one other crew. So a lot of times, we went out solo.
So just one or two planes instead of dozens of bombers in formation.
Completely different than what was in the European theater. They were high altitude, and we were strictly. That's why they developed this B-24, so the Navy could use it for long runs, long distances, to be able to knock out their communications, their transportation, the bridges, railroad cars. We had a good time up in Korea. A lot of people don't realize that we bombed Korea. We flew into Korea and knocked out a bridge and a railroad train, and a few other things that we did in Korea. Not a lot of people know that. I get a lot of questions, but you bombed Korea? Yeah, we did, because the Japanese had it. We had to be very careful if you got shot down, which Korean you were going to go to, because there were certain ones that you didn't want to get in contact with to get you back alive.
Were you afraid that you would get shot down? Did you allow yourself to think about those kind of possibilities, that you could be killed or captured in the work you were doing?
It really never entered my mind that we would get shot down. You always think you're going to come back. That's the way it was. If you got shot down, it was too bad. But you knew it could happen. It could happen. But we were fortunate we didn't. We come back.
Yes, you did, and we're thankful for that. When we come back with more of Hometown Heroes, we'll dive further into Don Straub's experience aboard those PB-4Y-2 privateers in the Pacific during World War II, and we'll find out how he came to be a star athlete at what was then Colorado A&M. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending the hour today with 89-year-old Don Straub of Windsor, Colorado. He served as a radio man and gunner on PB-4Y-2 privateers, the Navy version of B-24s during World War II, flying low-altitude missions with VPB-109, that stands for Patrol Bombing Squadron. He spent time based in the Philippines, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. And let's pick up where we left off.
I think the worst place in the world that we were was Iwo Jima. It was a horrible place. It was tough to fly off of it. There was a sulfur coming out of the runways, and it was just a horrible place to be.
Well, and folks obviously have heard about Iwo Jima, and they know what the Marines did, and maybe they know that the whole reason the Marines were there was just so planes could be able to hop over. When did you get there, and were there still some reminders of what had happened there on the ground?
Oh, yeah. We got there in June. We went from Tinian to Iwo, flying Dumbo service, looking for 51 pilots, 29 crews, so we could get in touch with submarines so they could pick them up.
So you guys were flying low altitude, just scanning everything to try to spot downed pilots so that the people in the water could rescue them.
That's exactly right. And we'd be back in touch with them to tell them where they were. That was primarily the job.
And how often did you guys actually spot someone? Was it something where you're looking hours a day and maybe once every few days you see someone? Or how frequent did that actually occur?
It didn't occur to us. I mean, our crew, we never spotted anybody. But we did. One afternoon, we were in touch with a submarine, our submarine. In order to make contact, you had to have identification, friend or foe, on your gear. It was not turned on. The sub made the surface, and a minute he broke surface, he was gone again, because we didn't do the right thing, and it was our fault. But the pilot forgot to put the IFF on, identification, which that sub would have got. But that was a scary moment there. I thought, oh boy, these guys are coming up here and looking for us, and they think we're somebody else. They're liable to surface and shoot at us, for crying out loud.
They probably thought the same thing of you.
Absolutely. That's why he stuck a nose down and went back down again. Oh, yeah.
You talked about the plane getting shot up a little bit. Is there one story or a few stories that really illustrate that maybe once you came back from that mission, you had to catch your breath a little bit and say, wow, that was close?
It happened out of Okinawa a lot. We were in Okinawa when they were still fighting down in Naha. We were up on the Yantan airstrip, and we would fly there, and we'd go along the coast, almost into Japan. And we came, we bumped into some fighters that particular flight. And when we come back, we looked at, and we had bullet holes in the bottom of the plane. How they got there, I don't. But our propellers had dinks and holes in them. So we lost the propeller one afternoon on that flight. So it was a little scary. But most of the time, you got back without any real damage. We did lose our airplane the night that they came into Okinawa on a suicide mission. They crash-land their airplanes up on the strip, and our planes were parked up there, and we had guards. Of course, a guy from the crew would stay over there all night. Some of the planes that crash-land, the Japanese got out and were running up and down the runway or the tarmacs, throwing grenades into planes, and that's where we lost our first airplane. It was blown up that night. But there was one airplane that came right over the top of our tent area, crash land right behind us. Two of those Japanese got out of that plane. How, I'll never know. And one was dragging the other one when the Marines showed up and said, those two are still alive. And I saw the gun. They had a little gun, and I picked it. It was hot. I picked it up, and the Marine said, put that down. He's still alive. I dropped the gun. It was going to be a souvenir. And I ran, and it was... But that was the most frightening night I ever remember. It's when they crash-land and destroyed a lot of the airplanes, which I have a picture of in my book. I'll show the tail section was all that was left. Then we got another airplane out there. They flew one out.
Were you actually asleep when this started? Were you? Did this wake you up?
It was at nighttime, yes, and they came over. When we come back off of a mission, we were able to go out. They would take us out to a seaplane tender for shower, ice water, and some nice food. And that was kind of a treat. You knew you were going to be if you got back okay. We didn't make a bomb that day, but that night is when they came over. And I mean, there was, I don't know how many airplanes, but I've got some pictures of them laying around, and it was a scary night. We didn't know whether there was more alive or whatever it was. They knew the island better than we did.
Is that one of those, when you think back on it now, where you think someone was looking out for me, or I'm pretty fortunate to be around, that maybe we came close to Colorado State not making the 1950 College World Series?
I never thought about Colorado in the College World Series in those days. All I know is I want to get home, which I did. I'll never forget that night as long as I live, ever. And that was the most terrifying night. Because you didn't know the island, you didn't know about the island, you don't know if there were Japanese still out there, because the battle is still going on in Naha, and the Marines were battling. They had to help out the Army, because Marines went north and cleaned out things, and then the Army went south. They got stuck, and that's when Marines had to come back down and clear out the bottom part of Naha and Okinawa. But then we were told to move when it was all over. We had to move to another airstrip.
The whole time you were over there, and I imagine as transient as you guys were with all the moving here and there, that it might have been hard for people back home to get a package to you. How often did you hear from your family?
We did letters. That's all. I never got a package. Never was sent any package. Very few of us ever got any packages. We did get mail, and we couldn't write very much because they would censor ours because we were moving around so much. But I did bump into a Marine in our tent area who was from my high school, and they were able to write a letter to their folks telling them where they were. But we couldn't. So when my mother would get my letters, it was all chopped up. And she never knew where we were until I saw this friend of mine. I said, well, you write your mother, tell your mother to call my mother and let her know where we are. And that's how she found out we were at Okinawa. Letters were letters. It was nice to have them, but I never made a big deal over the letters. It was just nice to hear that somebody was home on leave or liberty or whatever it was. Well, maybe we'll get back home. I'll be home soon. I was homesick. You bet I was homesick. I wanted to get home.
Did you ever have enough time to, in wartime, I realize culture is skewed a little bit, but to get to know a little bit about some of these islands that you were on and see what the natives, how they lived?
Oh, yeah. We were down in the Philippines, and I don't know what they were called or what tribe or whatever it was, but they come in one evening, loincloths on, hair up in the air. And they were hunters. They had big swords, knives, and they were out looking for the enemy. They were helping our situation out there. And there was probably 7 or 8 of them that walked into our tent area, which was quite a surprise. We did go to a little town in Port Prince in the Philippines. We were in Palawan, which is the southernmost tip of all the islands. The thing was that we went into town one afternoon, and we were having a good time, and this family took us in, and they gave us some of what they called their beer, and we drank that and did some things and had some fun with it and then came back. But that's as close as we ever got to any town, but it was only for one day.
When you think back on all those missions and everything that you went through, is there one moment that you think that was the closest I came to not coming home?
Well, I think it was the run we made up in Korea to knock out the bridge. That was a little scary. We were jumped by the enemy aircraft after we had done a lot of the damage. That one was probably the worst of all. But they all had significance to them, hoping that you don't get blown out or you get back okay. Every mission. One time I was grounded. I was drinking warm beer at Iwo. And I broke out, and I didn't know what the devil hives were. I had no idea what they were. I went to the doctor, and he says, well, he said, you been drinking any? I said, yeah. He said, you been drinking warm beer? I said, yeah. He said, that's it. So the crew flew that day, and I didn't make that, but I was not able to go because I didn't know. I thought I had some crazy jungle disease. I didn't know what the hives were. Gosh. But Iwo, to me, was a horrible place. You took a shower in salt water, although we did have Quonset huts. The officers had tents, the pilots. We got rain off of the roofs in barrels so we could wash ourselves, but you had salt water soap. It was a horrible place. Of course, they had the whole island was tunneled, and we walked into some of those things, and they had shelves cut out to where they slept.
I've heard some stories about some of those caves and tunnels being booby-trapped, too. Did you ever hear about any of that?
Oh, that's very true. I think the things were pretty well cleaned up when we got there. The southern part was Mount Suribachi. They could not believe that the American Seabees cut a road to the top of that thing. And we were, I said, holy smoke. Coming into it, we flew over those landing beaches that they hit. Boy, and they shelled it. We shelled it and bombed it and bombed it. And it didn't do very much because of the lava. It would just hit and smother the bomb, nothing. They were ready for us when we got there. We were not in actual ground contact, but we knew what was going on. But they cleaned it out pretty well. After the Marines cleaned out the Suribachi area, then they moved the other way and did a good job. That was a tough situation for those guys.
Specifically about your missions, you know, people heard you say that you're flying 100 to 200 feet off the ground, and we've heard, you know, fighter bomber pilots flying P-47s or P-51s, that they would do skip bombing, and we've heard about how they did that. But when you're flying basically a B-24 that low and dropping a bomb, how do you avoid being impacted yourself?
When you make your run, you open your bomb bay doors, that thing takes a few minutes to get it down there. You're beyond the ship then. You're beyond it. There's no problem. But we were strictly low-altitude bombers. Reason was that we could do a lot of damage. We ended up with what is today a missile. We had what they called the bat bomb. It was attached to our wing. And I would operate that when the pilot would say release, to throw forth. It was like the radar and that bat bomb. It was the first thing ever came out. And our squadron was awarded that. I don't know how many worked, but I know that some of us got rid of them once in a while. But that, to me, was the first kind of missile thing. It was an automatic bomb.
So you would press a button, and it would release and go?
Release it and just take off, and you had it geared to the target. That's just the first thing I ever saw then. It was a dumb-looking thing.
What was it propelled by?
It was just let it go, just like a bomb.
It would just coast in like a glider would or something?
Yeah, just like that. Of course, the Japs had one of those things, too, like the rockets that they had in Europe. But I saw one of those on the island of Okinawa.
You mentioned earlier the timing with the bombing of Hiroshima and how that crew had been lost the day before. But when you guys found out that Imperial Japan had surrendered, how significant was that news to you, and how did you all react?
When the first thing hit, it was raining, it was soggy, and the pilots came down to tell us more about it, to our tent and our crew. That was the evening that we celebrated. But now we were concerned, and then they dropped the second one. And now we're thinking, boy, maybe it's all over. Well, it was. It was all over then. And we were thinking about, let's get home, let's go out. And that's when we started to put things back together and worked our way back. We come back to Guam. We had to spend 2 weeks in Guam in order for the commander in the Pacific, Nimitz at that time, told us in Guam, you can fly your airplanes all the way back to the States. So we went from Guam to Johnson Island to Honolulu. We spent a couple, three, 4 days in Honolulu, and we flew off of Barbara's Point. Started out, and we had engine trouble, had to come back, and we're thinking, oh God, are we going to make it? Come back, had it fixed, and we come back the next day, took off, went all the way, then we flew into Naval Air Station Alameda, and we were home. I got on my knees and kissed that ground. Boy. And we had to contact them and tell them who we were, where we're from. Alameda had no idea. Here we come in with these airplanes and that big broad painted on the side of the plane. We were kind of an unusual group coming in there.
What was it like to see your family again after everything you'd been through?
That's a story in itself. We were waiting at Naval Air Station to get leave to go home. A lot of the guys were awarded the DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross. And I was on the plane that we made this bridge run and knocked out the bridges and everything else, and I manned the turret.
That was in Korea?
That was in the Korea deal. Anyway, our ACI officer, the intelligence guy, was quite a guy, a teacher. He taught then at Columbia University later on. He issued the different awards. Well, I went up to him. I said, Commander Steele, I says, I was on that flight. I was in that airplane. Why didn't I get the DFC? He says, let me tell you something. He says, there's going to be a lot of guys getting discharged, and there's going to be a jam out there. And you could get a DFC. You got a DFC. You got discharged almost immediately.
Because of the points you got from it.
Exactly. Well, I didn't get the DFC, but the third-class radioman got one. And so Steele, that's what Ted Steele, Commander Steele, said to me. He said, Don, I'm giving you a break. You don't want to go out there right now because everybody's coming home. And he knew that I wanted to go to school somewhere. So that was my delay. And I came back, and my good friend, his name was Ike Ritchie. He was from Hazard, Kentucky. We went to Los Angeles from Alameda. We thumbed at Los Angeles. And there were guys driving cars back east. You could pay $50, get a ride to Chicago. So we did. Well, Ike and I and another guy, Bill Smith, we got as far as Springfield, Missouri. I thought, damn, this is a nice town. We were the only sailors in town. So we had a ball. We had a good time. People took us into their homes. And we just, the next day, Bill went on to Illinois. Ike and I continued on thumbing from Springfield to Louisville, Kentucky. We got to Louisville, we're broke. We don't have a dime. So Ike gets a hold of his mother and dad. They send us money for a Greyhound bus trip to Hazard, Kentucky. Have you ever been to Hazard, Kentucky? I haven't, never been. But Hazard is a little old mining town. And that's where I spent some more of my liberty with Ike and his girlfriend and sister. And we did a little of that Blucom drinking, that White Lightning stuff that they make down there, which is very good. But boy, it burns. So when I got home on the train from Louisville to Pittsburgh, I probably had maybe 10, 12 days of my leave left. And so that was it. And I had to get back on the train, come all the way back out to Alameda, and spend another 3 or 4 months. I was discharged in March or April of 46 in St. Louis, Missouri. I flew Naval Air Transport Service as a crewman out of Olathe, Kansas, and went from coast to coast, and then I had enough points to get out. My service record is all right there.
When you think back of those days, and you've shared a good chunk of it, I'm sure there's much more inside your brain from those days, but what, when you think back on it, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of the guys who won the war, and I'll still say the reason that we were so controlled and so dedicated is growing up in my time, what your mom and dad said to you, you did it. Or somebody else said, this is the way it's going to be. That's the way it was. And I think the fellows that were in the service brought that with them. And when the commander, whoever it was, said, this is what we're going to do, this is what you're not going to do, we did it. And that's what I think got us to where we were at the end of the war. Because I think we were conditioned to that kind of control. That's exactly the way I look at it, and I may be wrong, but I still think when my mom and dad said, you don't do that, I didn't do it.
Well, and that's going to lead us right into the story of how you ended up here on the Front Range in northern Colorado, wearing those beautiful pumpkin and alfalfa uniforms of Colorado A&M, since then, of course, having morphed into the green and gold of Colorado State University. That story involves listening to your father, I know, and little did you know, you'd make a little College World Series history in Omaha. We're going to get to that part of the story from 89-year-old Don Straub when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with the birthday boy, Don Straub, celebrating 89 years this weekend. Originally from Pittsburgh, he lives now in Windsor, Colorado. And we're going to find out how he ended up in that part of the country. We've heard about his work as a radio man and gunner on PB-4Y2 Privateers in the Pacific. He told us how it all went down when he was discharged in the spring of 1946. And I know you're now in the Colorado State University Hall of Fame because of your athletic exploits. But tell me how it was that you came out this way.
I wanted to get to college somewhere, and through some individuals, we had a basketball team in the squadron, and this lieutenant commander said to me before we went overseas, if you come back alive, I'll get you in any college you want to go. So when I did get back, I got in touch with him, and I was at SC out in Southern California, and a month in being an ex-GI and having parties, and he says, ah, the heck with it, I don't want to. I went home. I got home. My dad wasn't too happy about it because he had told all his friends, who incidentally only went to the eighth grade in high in school. He was proud to say that his son was going to college, and I wasn't. So he was a little upset. I went and got a job, quit the job, came home, started packing my bag. He came home from work. Where are you going? As I'm going to college, he said to me, you go this time, you stay, and he meant it. And that's when I took off to go to Colorado, and I had no idea what Fort Collins was. I didn't know anything, but I knew there was a Boulder, Colorado, CU, because of Wizard White in the old days. I knew about that, but I didn't know anything about Fort Collins. I arrived here on a Thanksgiving weekend in Denver with a suitcase, top coat, pork pie hat on. I'm going to college, not knowing what a cow town it was. So when I got on the bus, I got a suitcase, and I'm trying to get on the bus. All the kids are coming back to on their Thanksgiving vacation, and I'm fighting just to stand on the bus. And they're looking at me like I'm a, you know, I don't belong really with the clothes I had. Yeah. Well, I arrived in this little bus depot here in Fort Collins, and that's when the commander was here in town and the basketball coach. I met them at there, and they headquarters for me, and that was the start of it. And I figured if I better go to school, I'm going to go away to college so I can't get home on the weekends and say, ah, the heck with it, I'm not going to go. I couldn't get home. I had to stay.
And you played a year of basketball, a year of football. You swam for a year, but all 4 years you played on the defunct baseball team. Colorado State doesn't have baseball anymore. Maybe they should bring it back, honor your legacy. And your senior year, was it, that Lefty Straub won 11 games?
Yeah, we did. We won 11 games.
So you were undefeated as a pitcher. You had a perfect record going to Omaha. The first time the College World Series was ever in Omaha, you were there pitching for Colorado State.
Yeah, I won 11 ball games. What really put our ball club together was a little fella by the name of Dick Kitamura, who was from Hawaii, and he was the shortstop and kind of gelled our whole ball club. We did have some great ball players. But we went to Omaha after we beat Utah State for the Skyline Conference and then eliminated Greeley, which is now University of Northern Colorado. We went on to Omaha. I didn't fare too well. Pitched against Wisconsin on Friday, and we had a luncheon that afternoon before the game. And one of the guys from Bradley said to me, he says, you guys are going from Utah and Colorado. You're going to go up against a pretty good ball club of Wisconsin. I said, when did you fly in? I said, we didn't fly in. We drove in here and three station wagons and a pickup truck. So he told me, he said, whatever you do, don't change up on the catcher. His name was Red Wilson, who ended up playing with the White Sox. And I said, okay, that's great. Game starts, I'm pitching, we're getting about the third or fourth inning. We're behind. Wilson comes to the plate. I think I got him. I got two strikes on him, and the ball, I said, I'm going to change up on him anyway. I did. He hit that doggone thing. It might have gone through the wall. I don't know. But he did. And I thought, well, I learned a lesson there. But we got beat by Wisconsin. I came out in about the sixth inning. We lost that game 7-4, and we had to come back on Sunday, and we played Texas, which went on to win it that year. And I went 9 innings against them and got beat 3-1, and then we were on our way home. But that was the start of the whole baseball, which I'm very thankful to Colorado and everything else. I signed a contract with the Braves, and they assigned me to Denver in the Western League and played with some good ball players and knew a lot of them that went to the major leagues.
What was your best pitch?
Fastball, really, was a fastball, and I had a decent changeup. I had a little trouble with the curveball because I got a small hand. I couldn't really cover the ball, but it worked for me. That was my three pitches. I didn't know what a slider or whatever they call them today, a four-seamer, a two-seamer. That was not known in our days. I mean, it wasn't. But it was developed by good pitchers today.
You said a fastball was your best pitch, and I know they didn't have the radar guns everywhere back then. And Bob Feller famously was throwing over 100 at that time, and he was kind of the gold standard. But how hard do you think you threw?
You know, I don't think I could even answer that question honestly because I have no idea. All I know is that when I had to have it, it was there. But I wouldn't even try to estimate how fast it was going. But I got by. I did very well in my first year in pro ball and then was able to go on from there. Like I said, I had a cup of coffee, but no cream and sugar with the Braves organization. And ended up finally with the Braves organization, came up with a rotator cuff problem in my left arm. They operated. I laid out a year. I came back. But I wasn't throwing like they said I could. And so I figured, well, I've got a family now. I got two houses to keep. I might as well just forget about it. So I left the game, and I went in to Colorado, or back to Colorado. Taught some school in Denver for a while, and then was able to go to a very fine company and work for the Adolph Coors Company as a sales representative.
You turned in 89. How often do you play golf?
I try to play as much as I can. My wife and I enjoy it very much together. And she's pretty darn good also. How often do I play golf? If you look outside, there's no way to can play now. But that's what I miss. I mean, that's my activity. That's the only thing I do. But the winter time, you don't get to change.
Got any holes in one?
No, but my wife does. Yeah. And that really is something to behold as far as I'm concerned. We were at Ojai out of Ventura, and we were playing. We would go on weekends and play. So we're at Ojai, and a number 10 goes over the top, over the water, and into a hole. It's a three-par. So we're on number 10, and there's a tournament going off on number 1. It's on the public course up there, not the Ojai Resort. Well, Susie hits the ball. It goes over the water, bounces twice, and in the hole. And you would have thought it was a football audience back there. They raved and clapped, and everything. She put that was her hole in one.
Well, now I know what keeps you golfing. You've got a matcher. I mean, you're going to be golfing as long as you live, trying to get that hole in one.
I hope so. But I enjoy it, and I'm just glad I'm still be able to swing the club and do the things I do. I know a lot of guys my age and are not able to do that, and that's a shame. So I'm very fortunate. There was some good genes somewhere along the line.
I guess so. I just have a couple more questions. One, about the College World Series, because I've been there, had the good fortune of calling Fresno State's championship there. Now they've got a brand new ballpark there, and I mean, this is a multi-million dollar deal that the whole nation's paying attention to. I imagine the very first year it was in Omaha, when you pitched there in 1950, it had to be a little different stage. What can you tell us about the atmosphere back then?
That drew a lot. You can't get a seat unless you've got people stay there and get season tickets year round. I mean, those seats are hard to come by. A little short story, in the year 2000, the 50th anniversary of the Rosenblatt Stadium, we got together from that team of ours in 1950, and I think there were six of us. We put a reunion together. Jim David was one of those who ended up playing defensive back for the Detroit Lions in the 50s when they were so good. He was the third baseman, and we went to Omaha, and we got together. There was six of us, and it was the old Rosenblatt Stadium in those days. And you couldn't get a seat. It was, they just follow that. It's a big supported event in Nebraska.
But in 1950, was it a little different?
No, it was full. It was that big. And Omaha has done a wonderful thing with the, and of course, after I signed my contract and was assigned to the Denver Bears here in Class A ball, the road trip comes up and we go right back to Omaha. So I'm right back in the ball club again. But that was, it was a good league. There was a lot of good major leaguers come out of that league. But Omaha had a great team that year. Oh boy, they had a good ball club. Earl Weaver was there, he was manager of the Baltimore. He played second base with Omaha. But that was a great experience. If you've never been to one of those College World Series, like I said at my speech at the banquet for the Hall of Fame, it's something to see. You can't believe the enthusiasm that the fans put into that, to schools that they don't probably know anything about except their football teams and so forth. And they do support it. I give them that credit. And look what they've done today, like you said, with that new stadium. Oh, it'll be there forever.
I don't want to start any trouble around Northern Colorado here, but does it bother you that your alma mater doesn't compete in baseball anymore? And do you have a dream of maybe seeing it come back someday?
I don't know. It's a weather situation, I think. Of course, Rule 9 is when they did it. They had to balance things out for the women and for the men. It's not the ideal place to be playing baseball because you don't know what the weather's going to be like in the spring. I can remember throwing 9 innings against the University of Wyoming in Laramie, and we had snowflakes the whole 9 innings. But it's cold, and I could see why they dropped the ball. And it's, the other sports would be the one to drop if they're going to drop anything to equal out the women and the men's sports. I met the president at a football game up in the Ram Room, and he said, well, maybe we'll have baseball back someday again. But I know that Utah is playing baseball. BYU plays baseball. New Mexico plays baseball.
Air Force right down the road.
Air Force plays baseball. But it was just one of those things. And I think it was the decision of the athletic director at that time was Thurman Thumb McGraw, who also made a great name for himself at the Detroit Lions and ended up as athletic director here at Colorado State University. He had to make a decision, and that was his decision, I think, to drop the baseball. Maybe they'll get it back. I don't know.
Well, I guess we're about out of time, but if there's anything else we didn't touch on that you want to touch on, feel free. And I guess the one more question that I have, because I've heard you share these great memories of playing sports at Colorado State and all your adventures with the Coors Company and out on the golf course with your wife. You talked about your kids. I'm sure you have grandkids. Do you ever stop and say, wow, none of that would have happened if I didn't survive all those missions in the Pacific way back when? And how do you explain the fact that you got to come home and have this life?
I don't know. The good Lord was looking out for me. I was a churchgoer growing up, and I think that's what it was. Speaking of grandchildren, I have a grandson, graduated from the academy in 2010, and he's now flying F-15s in England. He's going to be deployed somewhere. He's going to be sent out somewhere from England. But I can't imagine that little kid flying one of those aircraft, the size of those things. Well, those fighter planes are as big as the 24s that we flew in. My gosh.
Just a little bit faster.
Yeah, well, I've got 13 grandchildren. Happy for the whole thing.
Well, I just want to say thank you, first of all, for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Anything else that you want to share?
No, it was my pleasure, and you do a great job. You are great. Your questions, and you keep the subject. I enjoyed it very, very much.
Well, likewise, the pleasure's been all mine. That's Don Straub, 89 years old, of Windsor, Colorado. To see photos of him then and now, check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We're out of time for today, but join us again next time as we remind you through these stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.